ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Yes, I'm out in the wild again. I'm Lisa Leong, and this week I've been at South by Southwest Sydney, and I've come back with a doozy. For the second year running, This Week in Life did a live podcast event. This time we peered into the future to map the landscape of work and management in the year 2050 and beyond. So I'm going to introduce you to this beautiful panel that we've assembled for you. All right. So we've got Ryan Patel, round of applause. Globally recognised futurist, but has worked with so many businesses across the world and has been called to really give his advice and inspiration to so many. Okay, Greta Bradman, round of applause for Greta. You may know Greta in so many different guises. So she's not only a values coach, but she's also a registered psychologist. She's got her MBA. She's an entrepreneur. She's also my ABC buddy. So she broadcasts on ABC Classic, and I see her a little bit as we cross paths in the halls. And right next to me, Simon Kustenmacher. Round of applause. Simon is a social demographer, because we're talking about 2050, we really needed to have some data behind us. So I've invited Simon here, who's co-founder of the Demographics Group. Who is this manager of 2050, or what might they be? That is the provocation that we want to cover today. But we need to set the scene. So Simon, we want to go to 2050. I will be 78. I'll probably still be working. What does 2050 look like in terms of the workforce and who we will be?
Yeah, most importantly, Australia is going to be a much bigger place. We'll be adding roughly 9 million more people. That is essentially Brisbane and Sydney. But this growth isn't evenly distributed across the whole age spectrum. We are, for example, close to tripling the 85 plus population. And that's an important thing to remember, that we go from 580,000 85 plus year olds today to about 1.5 million. This aging population requires a workforce. Half of the 85 plus cohort needs care on a daily basis. And there is no scenario where we will have even remotely enough aged care workers in the system. Cannot happen, will not happen, end of story. So that means we need to pretty much can take it for granted that we will continue the high migration approach in Australia, because the skills shortage that we're seeing right now, that is also not getting better, because we push over the next 26 years or so, we're pushing so many people out of the workforce into retirement. We don't push more people into the workforce on the other end. And the while for the next two decades, there will always be an absolute bucket load of people in their 30s. These are people that go on parental leave, that leave the world of work at least temporarily. So we are running out of workers. The skill shortage is baked into the demographic pie. So that means that all those fun buzzwords that we will be throwing around today, AI, robotics, automation, these are not going to lead to hordes of angry, unemployed people. This is our fighting chance to have enough workers in the system.
So with this aging population and it being so, so massive, what are the implications then for the jobs? Because we can't ignore those kind of numbers, can we?
No, we can't. So we know from a workforce perspective, forever onwards, the fastest growing industry will be healthcare. So if you have a job in healthcare, you will never, ever be bored. That's for certain. You'll also not be out of a job anytime soon. So that means all the other industries also are short-staffed and need to find a way to get enough workers. There's one industry in Australia that would always be fine. That's mining, because mining can just throw money at the problem. But other industries cannot do this. We have a shortage in education coming up. So we then need to think about efficiencies and all of those other workflows. And that's when we go, well, how could we deconstruct a specific job, a workflow, and then take the automation approach? How many of those tasks could we automate? And so when we talk about aged care and robotics, we're not talking about robots flipping over old people. We're talking about making the workflows of an aged care worker more efficient so that they have a bit more time to spend on human-focused tasks.
All right, so you're painting a picture for us. I'm going to pick up something that you said. You said that we would mainly be congregating and living in big capital cities. What does that actually mean for our workforce if we're all kind of living in a concentrated way in the cities?
Well, what it meant so far is that everybody travels to the city in the morning, out of the city at the night at the same time, a star-shaped commuting pattern. It's the worst possible pattern to manage, gridlock and so forth. So we decided to fight this by working from home more and more. That eases our commuting pains. And everything in the short term points away from the office, meaning we want to work more remotely. That makes sense. But in the long term, the office will celebrate a massive comeback. Simply because we continue to shape the workforce in a sense that we have more people in the knowledge jobs, jobs that can be taking place in an office, but most importantly, AI will take tasks away from you as a worker that will actually be done by machines. And those tasks, whatever, they get super quick. This is programming, moving boxes around on PowerPoint. But the tasks that AI will not take away from you anytime soon are interpersonal creative tasks. And you will do those tasks in person with other people in an office. So in the long term, the office will be just fine. But I, of course, can say this because I don't own billions of dollars worth of office real estate. So what do I care?
All right. So, Ryan, you've been listening and waiting patiently there. I just love your reflections on how the American workforce compares to the Australian workforce, hearing the trends that you're hearing about.
Yeah, I mean, I think to pick up what Simon just said, it's not as easy as the workforce is going to be very hybrid to that degree. I think what we're seeing in the U.S., which I think we'll see here in Australia, there is a very fight of tension of what work is. So think about this. Before COVID, you know, I still remember that, you know, you took a Skype call at home, you had to tell your kids to be quiet so nobody knows that you're actually working. Now it's deemed okay, and you had a lot of companies come out and say, we're never going to go back. Why I'm painting this picture, because today there's a fight. There's many companies are now checking when you come into the office and scanning. Are you coming in? What time are you coming in? So it goes back to the notion of what happened to the hybrid work. And I think hybrid work is here to stay, but it takes a lot of effort. And I think here in Australia, there's a little bit of a different culture of a little bit more vacation time and to understand the human and the worker, right? That there's a little bit more of an understanding of that. And I think that's important when you have to do hybrid work, right? The culture has to change. It's not a cookie cutter aspect. And I know that we're going that way, but I think we're really at a crossroads right now because there's a lot of tension in the realm about should you work from home, should you be there, and what are you missing out?
Before we go to you, Greta, I do want to just you to set the scene, please, Ryan, for 2050, the kind of technology, artificial intelligence, where are we heading? And I want you to shock us a little bit. What are you seeing on the horizon that we don't know about right now?
I mean, it's going to happen before this. The term AIPC, you know how we all pay with our phones right now and we don't think about it and you just do it. 10 years ago, you'd be like, I don't trust it. You know, this time next year, what are you going to do when it reads your emails and it says, hey, you didn't get back to Ryan, but here's a note. Do you want me to send it? By 2050, the technology will be very, very scary.
Greta, so you've listened to the context in which we'll be operating in 2050. So who is this manager in 2050 from your point of view with a lens on values?
I think that first off, I would say if there are people doing the work, there are going to be people managing those people. That's an assumption
that I have. So
it's not by
Terminator. To some extent.
I think that what Simon was talking about in aged care is really interesting. I'm erring on the side of not so much the, I suppose, machines turning people over, but can you synthesize empathy? And I would argue that yes, you can, if empathy is something, if it is a skill that can be developed. If you can do that more systematically with technology, I think that really begs the question, well, if empathy is in the eye of the beholder, then is that going to mean that there are actually, you know, there's more AI in the interpersonal space than at the moment we would predict there to be? But then we have that more elusive relational component to interactions. And I think it's that relational component which has really, and a diminishing of opportunity to have that incidental validation that is about me as a human, you as a human, and less about our roles and the work to be done. That has contributed to an erosion of culture within organisations. And I think that that is part of what has driven work organisations to get people back to work, when initially they might have thought, hey, remote work and hybrid work actually is going to save us money. And they're starting to discover, no, it's not, because it's actually really hard to make up for that relational component and the need for that relational component in order to drive belonging and drive engagement and drive performance.
So let's look at an ethical dilemma. Let's say that in this organisation, the manager is collecting your data because you've got, you know, the sleep rings, biometric data, you're feeling sad maybe 3 days in a row, maybe 2 weeks in a row, and the manager wants to intervene on it. Is this going too far?
Well, I'd go back to choice is the idea. At the moment, we feel like there's no choice and we feel a bit like the victims of technology. But who says that we can't have a say? If I look at my Twitter X account, why the hell is this feeding an algorithm that I have no say? Why can't I say, hey, I want this non-political, maps-only Twitter account. I enjoy that. I want that. Can I have more of a say of what I'm being shown? I can do this by Googling a specific thing and then it shows me these things. I should have the say in more of those aspects. And I think ultimately we will get a bit more choice, because it's too simplistic to forecast 26 years into the future and say these trends just happen a straight line. There will be absolutely no say. I'm sure that there will be regulation coming in. We always say in forecasting that regulation follows innovation. And if we look at AI, we know that there will now be easily a decade and a half of just crazy, wild west, unregulated stuff that'll create absolute gigantic winners. But sooner or later, we will then regulate this. We see this now. Airbnb, Uber, they did just random stuff as they pleased around the world, and now they're being regulated bit by bit. And it always takes a decade plus, but we'll eventually get there.
I think for me, I would answer that question, Lisa, by saying I don't think it's going to be productive or useful for us to try and measure everything about, you know, about people. So collecting every ounce of data, I don't think one will be necessary in order to presumably get to the desired outcome, which is optimizing performance, and then taking back from that, looking at the drivers of that, one of which is well-being. With that in mind, the interesting question is, what are those pieces of information that are needed about an individual in order to drive the predictions that, say, a manager could be assisted with? And I think that, for me, the role of AI in moving forward is providing an attention spotlight. And, you know, an attention spotlight that is based on a bunch of probabilities, a bunch of data that helps a manager, for instance, know where to focus and why. And to do that in a really ethical way that actually seeks to minimise the bias of that manager towards a given worker in order to support them.
All right, Ryan, come on. This is your playground.
First, I'm not giving you my data. No, I'm tired or not, steps or anything. So both what you have said is perfectly spot on. I think where I would push here is, if we're talking about the work, if you put a company in the ability to say you have this data and you can make more money or make people, what are they going to do with it? And so what is scary is if there's data behind it going, if you get to this real quickly, this person becomes 2.2 more productive, this, which leads to X, Y, Z, which there will be data on those things.
Yeah, you could have heart rate variance of your team.
Lisa's about to take this scary to another level in a minute. I was just trying to keep it simple, but at least I guess what I ate.
That.
I'm mad right now because I've skipped lunch. He knows that, but he's using that against me.
I wanted him to be hangry for this panel.
The area, though, because I do think there's a middle ground. You know, it doesn't have to be, because I agree. I mean, you know, there are some areas of data that should not be handed over or expected. But at the same time, I think that at the moment there is an underappreciation of the role of, for instance, well-being and the impact of well-being on performance. You know, where is that middle ground such that there is an, you know, a range of ethical layers of protection But at the same time, there is a greater appreciation made possible through data around the role of well-being and the importance of looking after the well-being of people for the sake of performance, because at the end of the day, that's going to be...
Well, that's why I think it's really great to have this. The thing that I'm scared of is that who here downloads apps and reads the whole thing? No one's forcing anyone for you not to read it, yet you still do it. App gets hacked, you're still downloading it. And so I don't say we're going to get to that point. I hope we don't. I think people will be more protective of this data. But I also have to know there's a human component to it.
And the human component just needs to be managed in a centralized legal way. You cannot expect every person to look after their own privacy data. It's just too much.
ABC This Working Life. This is a live recording from South by Southwest Sydney, where I took the stage with demographer Simon Kerstenmacher, business futurist Ryan Patel, and values coach Greta Bradman. Who here is super conscious of the data that they're giving away, to the extent that, yeah, so that would be
30% of the audience.
30%. And so the rest of us, what, we just sign up all our sleep data and everything? Yes, that's me. So this is interesting, right? And especially when organizations, you know, who really do want to focus on sales and profitability and productivity, it's just that little slippery slope which could take us into a dark place. Ryan, can you help us extrapolate out? Where could this go?
I've heard so many things about the cautionary tale, robots are going to take over humans and those kind of things. But I also think technology is great, but being present is something that's really important. And I think we are going, technology is moving so fast that we are not able to keep up. And here's the thing that I'm probably scared about. Governments, they're behind of keeping up with the innovation, and it's super clear. And then who's leading it? Is it just the businesses who are throwing things out there, which is good that they're starting somewhere? And then what does it do for consumers? Who's got the voice? There isn't really anything right now that I can point to say we should go copy this model as society to say to do this. So that is a scary thing. I mean, it's scary, but it's like we need to move faster to create this. And I think the beacon of light, I would say, is can technology make you, you know, save you time, be productive, spend more time with family, know your health, do things that make you better as a human so you can make an impact? I like to believe that. Like, that would be really great to use it. Now, I think all of us have to adopt it a little differently, even for me, where I don't really have a lot of trust into, like, well, where am I giving my data? Where are you using my picture? But the more that gets out there, the more this data points. I mean, I still get scared when my wife researches we're going to Sydney and I get something in my LinkedIn feed or something like that, or Instagram feed going, hey, we're going there. And so to me, that's good and bad at the same time.
So we did the cautionary tale. Let's look at the ray of sunshine on the horizon here. So we're talking about 2050, and we're talking about the data and AI and the good things that we can do. What is that ray of light, the hope, particularly arming ourselves for the future that we've forecast here today? Greta.
I believe that technology can help with loneliness and achievement. And I think that if we can integrate technology in a way that enables us to connect not just with one another, but with other forms of intelligentness. I'm going to stop saying that. I'm not going to say life, obviously. Then actually that can be like a really positive thing for us to be able to process things, to talk things over, to feel validated, and to feel more connected to what matters to us.
Right, so Ryan, give us the ray of hope.
Technology and the manager of 2050, inclusiveness. I think we have an opportunity to be more inclusive and global and connected. So just keep thinking about by the time we get there, we can have different groups of people to be underbanked, those that were not banked, to be banked, right? To those who couldn't have jobs, could be trained to have jobs that their careers would have taken generations. How to manage... I should just full stop that. How to manage people, but how to really help grow people, right? We are at this point where we're still struggling with how to manage people from different backgrounds and cultures, and how do you educate that? And I'm not taking it as far as what you want me to do, but like, let's try to get the simple things first. It's going to take us 25 years to even get there. And I think this is an opportunity to be more inclusive. Again, just
so can you give us an example, like, so that we can understand how that might work? So how might...
So I would just use the, you know, I think accessibility, disability workforce is really under-tapped. And I think it is going to be very, very positive and very something that's going to be needed. And so imagine the technology that you can make and to help someone, if it's the desk or working from home, to be able to interact with people.
And how does the technology actually do that, though?
So, I mean, you're just in communicating. Just in communicating, if it's hybrid, if it's you don't have to come to work, you know, just the way that the workplace is set up to be interactive with people, like the perception is still real of when you meet people, right? So I think it'll make it a little bit less daunting as well. So, I mean, we can go make specific tech, right? It could be people think of something and it types up and you can interact that way, but I'm keeping it very simple in a way that people can kind of interact in a way that is just, oh, this is normal and it doesn't matter where you're from, what your background is.
Well, and I was also wondering whether it might be something like the metaverse where what I'm like physically isn't replicated in the other world, so the metaverse.
I would say we're probably not that ready yet, but I think the mixed VR aspect of it, that's could easily be where you can be in a meeting where you have your hologram or something of that degree, as long as it's normal, and people could be fun with it. Like, imagine work being fun.
All right, come on, Simon, give us a ray of hope.
If I'm looking at Australia in 2050 in particular, my main hope for AI is, and technology broader, is that it helps us to mitigate the shortage of workers. So that's relatively easy to imagine. So that's a positive development. And more than anything, I'm hoping in the positive sense that it can make our economy a bit more diverse. Remember that we in this country run a super simplistic economy. We do four things: mining, agriculture, tourism, and international students. That's all that we do. We export absolutely nothing else. The world cares about nothing else of what we do. But so the idea there is, could we make our economy more complex? Could we diversify the economy? And how would you consider if we say, we move more of the global economy online, digital? That means there's more and more footloose industries, footloose workers. And those workers will look at a world map and they go like, poof, I wonder where I want to live. So they go like something like a rich country, safe country. Maybe they go like democracy. That's nice. And when you look at all these type of filters, bit by bit, you end up with relatively few countries. And Australia is always in the mix, no matter how you play this game. And so in order to attract this workforce, in order to at least theoretically create this kind of ecosystem where global knowledge workers want to come here, we only need to make sure that our housing essentially halves in price. And then we want to pretty much want to cut our electricity costs down to 20-30%. And all of a sudden, we are the place to be in the world.
Well, I'll say one thing. I think Australia and the tech ecosystem and the startups that I'm familiar with, and I think the days where Australia is it's its own ecosystem and just a part of Southeast Asia is no longer the narrative. It is going to be global. I think, to your point, it's been slower, but I'm very excited for Australia for being a lot larger play in the rest of the world, and now I just need people to hear it, right?
And this is why you're here, to be honest. It's the idea that in Australia, we tend to be very pessimistic about the here and now because there are certain things that point downwards. Mm-hmm. Housing affordability, cost of living being the two biggest issues here. But if the world looks at Australia from the outside, this tends to be still a very, very positive narrative. We just need to be reminded of it occasionally.
I mean, the adoption rate of technology and the things are super high here, right? But then there's a slowing out of going out. And I don't think it's just an Australia thing. It's certain other countries. But when you think you've got something really great, you got to build that ecosystem. So it's got to flourish. And hopefully there'll be more things to flourish from.
And Ryan's moving to Australia.
Howdy, neighbor.
All right, am I getting paid in Tim Tams or how that works?
Can we thank our panel, please? Ryan Patel. Globally recognized futurist, go-to authority on global business, political economy, and corporate governance. Everybody. And Greta Bradman. our registered psychologist, values coach, performer, entrepreneur, and ABC broadcaster, and Simon Kirstenmacher. Co-founder of the Demographics Group. And thank you to our studio audience. Thank you to South by Southwest. Thank you to beautiful producer Zoe Ferguson as well. Round of applause. Thank you to our audio engineers, and thank you everyone once again. South by Southwest, Sydney.
Yay. I'm Lisa Leon. Thanks for listening to This Work in Life and for coming to South by Southwest if you're in the room. This episode was recorded on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. It's produced by Zoe Ferguson and Sam Wicks and mixed by Kerry Dell. Until next time, work it like a charm.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.